In our prayer with Michael, we thank God for our Savior Jesus and His death for us. There's a lot of churches that talk about Jesus and His love and His sacrifice, which is good. But here's the question. Is Jesus concerned about divorce and remarriage? Yes, I see some heads shaking. If someone were to ask you to prove it, where would you go? Matthew what? 19. Matthew 19.
Malachi.
What?
Malachi.
Malachi? Okay. Malachi's Old Testament. That would show the God's concern with it. I'm talking about Jesus. In Matthew 19, Jesus was asked a question. What was it?
Is it lawful
to divorce your wife for any reason at all? And He dealt with that question in a way that was actually very unpopular. So there's a lot of talk about Jesus and loving Jesus and Jesus' love for us. But the fact is, Jesus dealt with the topic of marriage and divorce. When He preached, did He preach about it? Can you prove it? How do you know? I see some heads shaking. How do you know He preached about marriage and divorce?
Sermon on the Mount.
That's right. Matthew chapter 5. So remember that when you're talking to your friends, because they'll want to focus on Jesus' love and sacrifice, which we ought to, just as Michael said in his prayer, we ought to remember it every day. But the Jesus Christ that you read about in the New Testament was also concerned about people's marriages. In our prayer with Michael, we thank God for our families. And God's the one that instituted this wonderful relationship, but He also has rules for its order. And so we're looking at that in our study on marriage, divorce, and remarriage. We studied two lessons on attitude, and then in our last class, we talked about the word marriage itself. If somebody asks you what marriage is, can you give me a very succinct answer? What is marriage?
Covenant.
What?
Covenant between two people and God.
Marriage is a covenant?
Relationship.
Marriage is a relationship between a man and a woman. Now, there's a lot of relationships between men and women. Is an employer-employee relationship such a relationship at times? Yes, just a relationship. But we're talking about a special relationship entered into by two things. That was your answer. What's the first thing?
Covenant.
A covenant. The second thing?
Sexual consummation.
So in our first class, we talked about marriage being a relationship involving a covenant where the woman is taken as one's companion, given in marriage, and they become one another's. If you weren't here for that class, I'd strongly encourage you to go back and listen to the class. Wally's uploaded these to the website, and you can listen to them as you do other things. But definitions are critical, and we'll be using definitions that we're establishing now contextually throughout our study. So, two things involve, two requisites for this relationship. One is a covenant. But the word covenant may have different definitions, different ideas to different people. So, we suggested to you on question number one that you consult a dictionary to see what it said about the word covenant. Did somebody write a definition down that they would share with the class? Okay, mutual consent or an agreement of the mind. That's a good definition. An agreement between two parties. Sometimes, for example, in one dictionary that I consulted, It says a binding and solemn agreement. This is Webster's New World Dictionary. You say, well, I agree with that, but what does solemn mean? A binding and solemn agreement. Now, that's the question. Looking up the word solemn, it says observed or done according to ritual or tradition. That's definition number one. So if a marriage is a solemn, a covenant that is a solemn agreement, does it have to follow some ritual or tradition to be a covenant? Now, when you read those definitions, what are the dictionaries telling you? That's how people use the word today, and that's what they may think of. You say marriage involves a covenant, they may say, I agree. But it has to be a solemn covenant. That is, it has to follow some kind of ritual or tradition. This becomes critical later in our study as to whether or not people are married and have the right to divorce or not. Another definition for solemn is this, according to strict form or formal. So a solemn agreement, does it follow some formal procedure? Is there a form that was followed when this agreement was made? Or was it just two people agreeing on something? And some would say if it's just two people agreeing, it didn't follow some particular form. If it wasn't a formal agreement, it wasn't a covenant. So they might say they were never really married. And that's why the definition of covenant becomes so critical. So what we're going to do is look at the definitions, the definition of covenant as it's defined for us by contextual usage. Now, first of all, you see the first thing we have on your lesson are two words that are involved in the definition of covenant. One is the word vow and one is the word oath. The word vow refers to a promise to do or not do something. The word oath is an affirmation of that promise. You can make a vow without an oath. But a vow is a promise to do or not do something. And then an oath by way of affirmation or confirmation of that vow. So we have some questions on your lesson. We'll begin our study in Genesis chapter 28, verse 20. The question is, must the vows be public? That is, for a wedding, a marriage to be a marriage, must the vows that are made be public? That is, in a ceremony with witnesses. And if it's not, if there's no ceremony and there are no witnesses, was there really a covenant between two people? So look at Genesis chapter 28 and verse 20. Now this is Jacob when he's going back to Paddan Aram, seek a wife. And you remember he dreamed and God repeated the promise to him in verse 13, 14, the three promises, the land promise, the great nation promise, and in your seed all families of the earth be blessed. And when you get down to verse 20, Jacob made a vow. Was a vow a promise to do or not do something? So Jacob made a vow saying, if God will be with me, what do you mean with me? That's verse 13 through 15. And will keep me on this journey that I take and will give me food to eat and garments to wear. And I return to my father's house, that is to my homeland, in safety. Then the Lord will be my God. Note verse 13. God said, I am the Lord, the God of your father Abraham and the God of Isaac. So if this happens, then the Lord will be my God. If sometimes has the sense of since, S-I-N-C-E, since God will be with me. Not necessarily conditional. Since God will be with me and keep me on this journey, then the Lord will be my God. All right, now that's chapter 29 and verse 20. Now go over to chapter 31 and verse 13. Chapter 31 and verse 13. 28:20, I'm sorry. Now go to 31:13. Now, when Jacob made this vow, were there witnesses?
Only God.
Only God, no human witnesses. Was there any kind of ceremony? No, it's just a promise to God to do something. Now look in chapter 31 and verse 13. I am the God of Bethel, where you anointed a pillar, where you made a vow to me. So did God expect him to keep a vow that he made when he was alone between him and God with no witnesses and no ceremony?
Yes.
Yes. So a vow to be binding does not require witnesses, does not require a ceremony. So when we talk about a covenant involving a solemn vow, that's where that word solemn can get us into trouble, because some people will say, well, it's got to be formal or follow ritual. But there's no form here and there's no ritual involved. He just made a promise to God and God expected him to keep that promise. Now, you'll note in your footnotes down at the bottom of the page, I have this first question with a little one beside it. We're not going to take the time, won't have the time to read all these other verses. But these verses serve to further confirm the point we're making. I do want to turn you to Numbers chapter 30. Numbers chapter 30. And you may want in your own study to read from verse 1 on through that chapter. It's only 16 verses. But I want to point your attention to verse 9. Chapter 30, verse 9. The vow of a widow or of a divorced woman, everything by which she has bound herself shall stand against her. So he talked about a woman making a vow in her father's house, verse 3, and that affecting her vow. But here's a woman who's a widow. She has no husband or she's divorced. But if she makes a vow, she's bound by it. No witnesses, no ceremony. Yes, Ronnie?
Finish what
you're
saying.
Go ahead.
Well, in the very first marriage, Adam and Eve, nobody was there but them.
Excellent point. The first marriage, nobody there but them. And so that covenant was recognized by God, and that relationship was recognized by God, and that's a good point that Ronnie makes. So you note back up in verse 2, here's the kind of introduction to this chapter. If a man makes a vow to the Lord or takes an oath to bind himself with a binding obligation, he shall not violate his word. He shall do according to all that proceeds out of his mouth. So we have a wedding ceremony, which I'm not sure they're great ideas except to satisfy society, because they've become more of a show than anything real. And I don't know that the couples, when they take the vows, are even thinking about what they're saying. But know what it says. Whatever comes out of your mouth, and what is it you say? I take this man or I take this woman for better or for worse, to honor, to keep myself to you and you alone until death do us part. That's a vow. And God expects you to keep the vow. Over in Malachi 2 in our last lesson, you may remember we looked at Malachi 2 about the priest. And they were not treating their wife by covenant as they should. What term did he use as to how they were dealing with them? Do you remember? treacherously. Person makes a vow, they don't keep their vow, that's treacherous. And that's what's happening all over our nation and all over the world. The world accepts it, God doesn't. And so a vow does not have to be public. So a man and a woman in the privacy of their home or in some other place make vows to one another. God listens to those vows. That's the important thing, whether anybody else listens or not. Look at 1 Samuel chapter 1. 1 Samuel chapter 1. And look at verse 11. This is also in your footnote 1. Look at verse 11. Hannah says, made a vow. And it's the vow that has to do with if God would give her a son, that she'd dedicate him to the Lord. Note verse 13. As for Hannah, she was speaking in her heart. How many people heard her? God only. Nobody heard her. The priest was right there. He didn't hear her. It says, only her lips were moving, but her voice was not heard. Was her vow one that she was bound to keep? Yes. And so young people, for example, may fall in love and in the heat of the moment make vows to one another, say, oh, I didn't mean it later. Nobody heard us. We didn't have a ceremony. Vows. You make a vow. It does not have to be public. Look at our next point, verse Deuteronomy 23. Say, well, I really didn't mean it. I made the vow, but I really didn't mean it. Look at Deuteronomy chapter 23 and verse 21. We ask the question, must the vow be sincere in order for the covenant to be valid? How do you answer? Yes? Everybody answer yes? No, the answer is no. Look at here. Verse 21, when you make a vow to the Lord your God, you shall not delay to pay it, for it will be a sin in you. The Lord your God will surely require it of you. Verse 23, you should be careful to perform what goes out from your lips, just as you have voluntarily vowed to the Lord your God. You vow it, comes out of your lips, you make the vow, you're bound by the vow. Now look down in your footnote. Look down in your footnote. We've got Ecclesiastes chapter 5. Look at Ecclesiastes chapter 5. Somebody said, well, I made that vow rashly. I'm not bound by it. In Ecclesiastes chapter 5, verse 4, when you make a vow to God, do not be late in paying it, for he takes no delight in fools. Pay what you owe or what you vow. It is better that you should not vow than that you should vow and not pay. Do not let your speech cause you to sin, and do not say in the presence of the messenger of God that it was a mistake. Why should God be angry on account of your voice and destroy the work of your hands? Oh, I just made a mistake. I didn't mean it. You made the vow. You better think about it before you say, I'll take you for my mate for the rest of our lives, the rest of my life. You make the vow. Whether you're sincere or not, I don't know, but you made the vow. And there's not an out by saying, oh, I really didn't mean it. You made the vow. And again, it's going to have a big bearing on whether or not people have a right to remarry. They say, I made a vow to somebody years ago, but I really didn't mean it. We really weren't married. Really? You made a vow? God expects you to keep the vow. And a vow is the way that people entered into covenants and agreement. Make a vow, promise to do something, and sometimes took an oath. Not always did they take an oath, but sometimes took an oath. All right, so now question number 5. If a vow is made rashly, does that invalidate it? In other words, without giving it thought and thinking about the ramifications and what could happen. Look at Judges 11. Judges 11. You're very familiar with this story. We'll not read the whole 10 verses. This is the story of Jephthah. Verse 30. Jephthah made a vow to the Lord and said, "If thou wilt indeed give the sons of Ammon into my hand, then it shall be that whatever comes out of the doors of my house to meet me when I return in peace from the sons of Ammon, it shall be the Lord's, and I will offer it up as a burnt offering." We're not going to get off into whether or not he offered his daughter as a sacrifice. A burnt offering in the sense, that sense, I don't think that's the case, but that's another study. The point is, he made a vow, and it was a serious vow. It affected his daughter and her destiny. He never expected his daughter to be the one to come out. But she came out, and so, verse 35, he was distraught. You see, he saw her, he tore his clothes and said, "Alas, my daughter, you have brought me very low, and you are among those who trouble me." Back then, they would keep animals in houses, and maybe he thought one of the animals would come out, and he'd offer that to Jehovah. He said, "I've given my word to the Lord." Now, note what he said. Here's a man of faith and loyalty. "I cannot take it back." He can't say, "Well, I made it rashly. I'm not. God will forgive me for that." No, I made this vow. And the young girl is also impressive. She says, "My father, you have given your word to the Lord. Do to me as you have said." Do what you said. And what I think it had to do with, verse 39, she returned to her father who did according to the vow which he had made, and the word "and" is sometimes explicatory. That is, not "and something else." Namely, she had no relations with a man. In other words, she was consigned to celibacy for the rest of her life. But be that as it may, whatever that part is, the fact is that here is a vow that was made without proper consideration of the potential consequence. So somebody said, "Well, when I made this vow, I didn't realize my mate would get to be a bum or fat or ugly or mean or dumb, whatever." Well, you better think about it when you make the vow. Because it's a rash vow, does not invalidate the fact you made a vow. Now, we don't live in a society that takes vows very seriously. You know that. But here we're reading from God's book. We use a phrase in our language, "Your word ought to be your bond." That's gone and passed of another generation, I guess. But that's what God's word expected. And this is particularly true with relationship to this relationship, the relationship of marriage. All right, let's just turn to Exodus chapter 23. Did you have a comment, sir?
Yes, I did. Just a question. So it kind of concerns me about these rash vows. When a person is under the influence of alcohol, drugs, or taking medication,
Good question. Of course, if being under the influence of alcohol will invalidate the vow, the thing to do before you get married is get drunk. And then when you get married, later you can say, "I was drunk." But that's a good question Rocky asked. Of course, the point is you better keep your mind sober. There's a word that occurs over and over in the New Testament that Christians are to be of sober spirit. Now, I realize he's not talking simply about not taking alcohol or drugs, but anything that would inhibit having sobriety, good judgment. That's very important to the service of this master that we prayed about a while ago. And so Rocky's point is a good point to think about, good thing to teach our young people, the dangers of alcohol. You say, "Well, I'm not going to get a wreck and kill anybody." What might you promise when you're under the influence of a drug or alcohol? Think about that. And so there may be some circumstances that I or you cannot judge, but that's a very good question that Rocky brings up. The case with Aaron and his two boys, Nadab and Abihu, What happened to those two boys? All right, look at Leviticus chapter 10. We use that passage to show the importance of recognizing God's authority for how we worship. So these two boys offered strange fire, it says in verse 1. And God struck them dead. Now later, when God is explaining to their father about what happened, look at verse 8. The Lord spoke to Aaron, saying, "Do not drink wine or strong drink, neither you nor your sons with you when you come into the tent of meeting, so that you may not die." Were these boys drinking? Maybe. Maybe. Didn't change the fact that they had a responsibility to recognize God's will. And so that's a passage to keep in mind. All right, let's look at Exodus chapter 23. And verse 32. Our question on the lesson is, does a covenant require an oath sanctioned by legal authorities? So here's Exodus 23:32. Here's God's law to Israel. You shall make no covenant with them or with their gods. So if a person made a covenant with one of the nation's gods, but it was not in the presence of civil authorities, could they argue they weren't in sin? Said, well, it wasn't sanctioned by civil authority, so there was no covenant. You know, that's not the case. Whether civil authority that sanction it or not, whether there's a ceremony or not, really doesn't make any difference. Whether there was an oath or not, an oath serves to affirm the validity of a vow, but the lack of an oath doesn't invalidate the fact that there's a vow made. If we have time, we can go back and look at this later. In Genesis 15 and Genesis 17, God made a promise to Abraham about his descendants. But it's not till you get to chapter 22 that it talks about the Lord swore or took an oath. And Hebrews tells us the reason God takes oaths is not because his word is questionable, but for the benefit of the people, to give them added assurance as to the truth of it. We shouldn't have to swear or take an oath. James says that your yes be yes, your no be no. But whether you swear or don't swear, that is, take an oath, nothing sinful about swearing in that sense, you're still bound by your word, by your vow. So these are important considerations, since a covenant, you enter into a covenant to enter into this relationship, and a covenant involves a vow to do something or not do something, then it's very important to understand what a covenant is, to understand if this relationship is valid. Look at 1 Samuel chapter 20. First Samuel chapter 20 and verse 16. Here's David and Jonathan. And so Jonathan's father, of course, was jealous of David and wanted to kill him. Jonathan was trying to protect him. And so here in 1 Samuel 20:16, Jonathan made a covenant with the house of David. That is, it involved his dynasty, not only him, but those who would follow in his rule. Say, may the Lord require it at the hands of David's enemies. Jonathan made David vow again because of his love for him. So here's a vow Jonathan took and David took. Was it at a courthouse?
No.
Were there legal papers?
No.
No. Any other witnesses? None that I know of. But here's a vow. And this goes along with what we're pointing at. A covenant does not require an oath that you take, that you hand on the Bible, or issued by a judge or a lawyer. And so you can enter into a covenant by making a vow with someone. And the oath is not requisite to the vow. Any questions about that or comments?
Just make me think about the New Testament when they lack the Holy Spirit.
When they what?
When and that's fire lacks the Holy Spirit. About how much they had contributed.
That's true. That's true. All right, so now let's talk about engagement. When people are engaged, are they in a covenant? Yes. An engagement is a covenant. It's an agreement to do something. But it's not the same as the covenant you take when you get married. The engagement covenant is something you promise to do in the future. Whereas when you're standing before your mate and you make a covenant to be their companion, their pure and single and honorable companion for life, you're ready to enter into that relationship then. And so, yes, engagement is a covenant, but it's not the covenant that's essential to a marriage. People can make a covenant and get married without a period of engagement. Yes. Somebody had a comment? Would you speak up a little bit? That's a good question. So people are going to get engaged and they make a covenant. They don't think about it, but it's serious. I remember when my son-in-law, Mickey, he's passed away now, but back when he and my daughter were dating, it was popular to give a girl a promise ring. So he wanted to give Celeste a promise ring. I said, okay, let's sit down and talk about this. Of course, you know, father-in-law talking to a proposed son-in-law, you know, brother. I said, what are you promising? Do you mean it? Is it just a ring? If it's just a ring, just call it a ring. But if it's a promise ring, what are you promising? And I was trying to make him think about it, what he was doing. Because a promise is a vow. And so, that's a good question Wally asked. Think seriously about this matter of engagement. Now, sometimes an engagement may be conditional. Make a vow conditionally. God makes conditional promises. And that condition may invalidate the agreement. But that's a good question that Wally asked. look at well, we can look at that later. Oh, yeah, look at Genesis 24. Look at Genesis 24 for just a moment. This is when Abraham's servant was sent to seek a wife for Isaac. So when he got there, verse 57 of chapter 24, they called Rebecca and said to her, "Will you go with this man?" She said, "I will go." What is that? It's an agreement, isn't it? I will go. She's agreeing to a covenant or an arrangement. So, we're going to talk in another lesson about fornication or rape or and adultery. There's no agreement to be husband and wife, but this woman agrees. So, she heads toward where Isaac is. And so, Isaac, verse 63, was in the field. Verse 64, Rebekah lifted up her eyes. When she saw Isaac, she dismounted from the camel. She said to the servant, "Who is that man walking in the field to meet us?" The servant said, "He's my master." She took her veil and covered herself. The servant told Isaac all the things that he had done. Isaac brought her into his mother Sarah's tent, and he took Rebekah, and she became his woman. Is that what Moses wrote?
King James says she became his wife.
So there's a different word for wife than woman?
No.
She became his woman. Translated wife, and good that they did. How long were they engaged? None. They met. Let's get married. So, engagements are fine. There are dangers connected with it if they're extended because of the temptations of the flesh. But at the same time, an engagement is not a requisite of marriage. And oftentimes it's not taken very seriously. All right, a question that often arises, we have in question number 8. Is an engagement the same as a Jewish betrothal? Now, if you study marriage and you consult commentaries, you're going to run across all kinds of things on this point. And brethren sometimes take off on that, say, well, it was an engagement, not a betrothal. Betrothals are binding and engagements aren't. The Jews took betrothals very seriously. And they went through a lot of ritual and tradition about the betrothal. The point is, there were Jewish customs that developed that served to solemnize the promise, But both these words, engagement and betrothal, basically refer to the promise to get married. Betrothal in their society may have had the trappings of their rituals connected with it. You will find your versions. One version will translate betrothed and another version engaged. So don't confuse the Jewish traditions with what the word basically means. A promise to marry. Here's a case where it was conditional. What did Joseph want to do? Put her away. Break the promise. Because he thought she had been unfaithful to him, which she had not. And so it was a conditional promise. But nevertheless, an engagement and betrothal, basically the same thing. Now, Ronnie brought up a good point a while ago. People say, well, a betrothal, a lot of emphasis on the, and you get it from secular, not the Bible, all the rituals connected with a wedding and a betrothal. What about the first couple? What ritual, what traditions were connected with their marriage? How many people were there? How many flowers? Any cake? Punch? No. And so what's happened over the years, we've associated a lot of practices, which in and of themselves are okay. But don't think that they are requisite to having a relationship called marriage. And this becomes so critical in talking with young people. Because they fall in love and They want to, I'll live with you, you be my wife, I'll be your husband. They live together for 5 years, and then all of a sudden something happens, they want to break up. Were you ever married? No, we never married. In other words, I never went to the courthouse. I never got a marriage license. I never bought a ring, so we weren't married. Really? Are you sure? Something to think about. So anyway, don't let this kind of thing confuse you. Now, when Jesus was asked a question about marriage and divorce, is it lawful to divorce your wife for any reason at all? Where did he take the people? Back to the beginning. That's right, Genesis 2. So that's a good practice. If you want to talk about marriage and its purity as God intended, what better place to go than back to the first account of marriage when God instituted this relationship, when it came fresh from the spring. And that's what Jesus did in his discussion of marriage. And our next class, if the Lord is willing, we will not have our class Sunday morning on marriage and divorce. We're going to be involved in a gospel meeting with David Watson. Starts Friday night, two services on Saturday morning, and then our three services on Sunday. Looking forward to some excellent and edifying lessons. But anyway, we'll not have our class on marriage, divorce, and remarriage. So our next class will be the next Wednesday. And we're going to talk about the second requisite to this relationship, and that is sexual consummation. We encourage you to be here for every class if you can. If you can't, don't get your concepts about marriage to be like a snaggletooth person. You know, a snaggletooth person missing this tooth and that tooth and that tooth. That's about the way some people's concepts of marriage are. They're missing this and missing this. Got this little idea over here and that one over there. Suggest that you go back, listen to the lessons, study the lessons, so you have a full and comprehensive view. Okay, thank you for your good comments and attention tonight.